Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the weekend and on Martin Luther King Day, people across the country took to the streets to raise awareness about racial inequality and deadly police shootings. According to an analysis by ProPublica, young black men are at a far greater risk of being shot dead by police than young white men, 21 times greater. Because of the Black Lives Matter movement, this issue is getting national attention. We're also hearing more about the issue of diversity in law enforcement. For example, the population of Ferguson, Missouri, where Michael Brown was shot and killed, is 67% black, but just 3 out of 53 police officers in Ferguson are black. According to statistics from the Bureau of Justice, people of color make up more than half of suburban San Francisco towns like Daly City, Hayward, and Fremont, but their police departments are heavily white. The percentage of blacks on Berkeley's police force, however, is higher than the percentage of blacks in the community. The total number of police officers of color has risen over the years, but they're concentrated in larger cities. The percentage of white cops is more than 30 points higher than in the communities they serve. So on today's Your Call, we continue our series on police, community, race, and justice by talking about the diversity of police forces today. Would more diversity change policing? Does this matter? Today, I'm joined by Jim Channon, a civil rights attorney based in the East Bay. Jim and fellow civil rights lawyer John Burris have filed many lawsuits against the Oakland Police Department, including the 2003 lawsuit over four officers known as the Riders. 129 plaintiffs alleged that the four officers beat them, wrote up false reports, and planted drug evidence. There was a settlement in which the clients got $10.5 million. None of the officers were convicted. One fled the country. As part of that award, Channon and Burris were involved in overseeing 51 mandated reforms for the department, and we'll talk about that today. Jim Channon joins me in studio. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning.
Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
I'm also joined by Marion Jackson, a board member with Officers for Justice, an organization representing police of color in the city of San Francisco. It was formed back in 1968. Marion retired from the SFPD after 36 years and spent 7 years in the DA's investigations unit. And Marion also joins me in studio. Hi, Marion. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
So, Marion, you've got many stories to share with us today. You've been working on the issue of trying to get more police forces diverse for decades. What really strikes you about the conversation we're having now and the fact that these numbers are finally starting to get out there?
Is that it was needed, I guess, since police started. However, now, with the advent of cameras and more alert citizens, they are beginning to talk about it. And I think diversity matters when it comes to policing because the community needs to see people like them being into the community, being the police. They feel probably more that they're going to get justice from someone that look like them than people who don't. Plus, that the diversity means that you know the people well. If I'm in a black community, I feel that that's where I came, so I know how they act and react and some of the needs that they have.
What are your thoughts on this, Jim? The conversation that we're having now and just the attention that's being focused on this issue?
Well, I think that it's clear that without a diverse police department that accurately reflects the community, you're not going to have anything resembling fair and impartial policing. And that you take a city like Ferguson, most of their problems, I think, stem from having almost all white officers and all men officers. Mm. That's a whole other thing we need to discuss, is the absence of women officers, both white and minority. But the diversity of the police department is just the beginning of the issue. Once you get your police officers, they have to truly reflect who they are and the community rather than not. And we've seen mixed success there. We've seen some cases where it just hasn't been the panacea that we had hoped. But it's essential, even if it isn't 100% effective. It's just it's a right you have as a young man or woman to have equal rights to be a police officer, no matter what your race or sex.
So we found some statistics from the Census and the Equal Employment Opportunity Office. There are 663,000 police officers nationally, 663,000, 70% white, 12% black, 2% Asian, 12.5% Hispanic or Latino, 0.7% American Indian, a total female about almost 15%. So, I mean, it's hard to kind of wrap your arms around those numbers, but what would you say, Marion, are the changes that you have seen specifically in the San Francisco Police Department and your efforts to try to diversify that department?
Okay. I haven't seen too much of a change. Every time we try to make progress, it seems like that black officers aren't hired. You know, I've seen academy classes come out where there's 50 people in the academy and only one black. So that ratio of 50-1 already, right? But I don't think also as a promotional-wise, we don't get the same. I think we to make it work, you have to get your administration and the police department has to be diverse also. And the people who are in there has to have the authority to make decisions and not just one person. You know, so I don't see, especially blacks in the police department in a lot of those positions, and those who are has to follow the protocol that was set up before them. Communities are policed differently. The black community and the brown community really don't have no say-so in their who polices them, where other communities do, right? So first of all, the black and brown community need to take charge of who polices them. And that means selection process, being involved in selection process, be more forceful on how they are policed. And somehow in those communities, the police has the community don't believe that they have any say so in the community because of the history of policing black people since slavery. But they do because policing is a community event. It's not a an event. The mayor should not, or the police department should not dictate how people are policed. The community should. In other communities, they are, right? You don't go into the white community and do policing like this. In fact, we did discuss early where very seldom you see white people killed by the police, but you see a lot of black people in those statistics you brought up.
Right.
However, white people kill police more frequently than black folk because they aren't on guard for whites, right?
I haven't seen those stats.
Well, I can say that over since 1979, I've done part or all of 21 wrongful deaths, and all but one were minorities, and nearly all the minorities were African-American, and all 21 were men. So there's a pattern. Also, when John and I did the Ryder's case, there were 129 plaintiffs who had drugs put on them and who served 40 years for crimes they didn't do, and 128 of them were black men. When we, 7 years later, we did the warrants case where it was admitted later that 2 out of 3 warrants in the Oakland Police Department were based on false information or perjury. We had 100 clients. 99 were people of color. So I don't think these numbers are coincidences. They actually reflect the kind of treatment that some minority people get from their police department. And it's even more complicated because in the Ryder's case, 3 out of 4 of the Ryders were minorities themselves. They were not African American, yet they picked on African Americans. They were Filipino and other kinds of Hispanics. So it's a little complicated, but what's not complicated are the victims. The victims are disproportionately people of color, disproportionately men, and disproportionately African American.
That is Jim Chan, and he's a civil rights attorney based in the East Bay. And you can read more about the Ryder's case at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Marion Jackson, a board member with Officers for Justice, an organization representing police of color in the city of San Francisco. It started back in 1968. Marion retired from the SFPD after 36 years, so he has seen a lot. If you have any questions for Marion or Jim about their experiences, we'd love to hear from you. And what are your thoughts? The issue of diversity or the lack of diversity in police departments across the country is really getting a lot of attention now. Do you think that diversifying a police force would change policing? As both of our guests says, there are lots of layers to this. It's pretty complicated, but the issue of diversity is very important. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What does the police force look like in your area? If you're a member of law enforcement, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Marion, in a city like San Francisco that's diverse, although we're losing a lot of blacks because it's so expensive now to live here, you said that if you look at the academy, for example, you've got 50 people and one black person. What explains that?
It's the attitude of the people that's hiring. I know once I talked to Hennessy, who was the sheriff, who has a lot more black deputies than and I asked him, how does he get blacks and the police department doesn't get black? And one of the things that he said was that it comes from the top down, right? You have to want blacks to hire them. I believe that we're scrutinized a lot more than white candidates, right? So consequently, credit counts, tickets count. And so if you're getting stopped more than anybody else, you can be disqualified just for getting 3 tickets, you know, within a year or so. And if you come from the black community and you haven't had a job in a long time, so you build up debt, that could disqualify you, right? So it has a whole lot of things in there that's very complicated. But it also is choices. When people are hired, I think if more blacks, more Asians or Latinos sit on those hiring boards, I think you would see more diversity.
Over the course of your 36 years at the SFPD, did you meet members of the community, people of color, who wanted to join the force but never got a chance?
A lot. Lots of them. And right now we're in a hiring frenzy because we're losing so many officers. Like, we need to hire around 400 people right now. But a lot of those people are being disqualified for whatever reason, you know. If they've used drugs in the past, like marijuana stuff, they could be eliminated. All of those things that hinder you. But it still goes back to who's hiring, right? Who sits on those boards, who's doing the scrutinizing, right? And I think we need more people of color that's in there scrutinizing the candidates. You know, and I think we will see more.
Jim, what strikes you about the recruiting process and some of the issues that Marion is raising?
Well, I agree with everything he said, frankly. It's a vicious cycle. When you're an officer on the street, you have more discretion. So if a young black man is smoking a joint, They tend to get arrested. They get a record. That sort of is the end of their ability to become a police officer. If a white man or a white person is smoking a joint, then they maybe get a warning, or they'll crush out the joint, or don't do that again. And then when they apply, it's as if it never happened. And then so you have that problem where the population who's eligible to become a police officer is shrunk by the very problem that we're trying to deal with. Then on the oral boards, there are people who they live in a white world, and they want that white world projected in their police officers, and that reflects their hiring practice. And then in the academy, I've represented police officers where one will make a mistake that another one would make, and then one won't get the job and the other one will. And it's all these subtle things. And by the time you get out of the academy, all prejudice on prejudice on prejudice, you have a different kind of a police officer than perhaps is reflective of the community. And even though, as I said before, having African-American officers, you cited Berkeley, for example, they're having a lot of trouble in their black community. The NAACP is very upset about the policing. So it's not the magic solution, but it's an essential prerequisite, even if you need more problem solving than just that.
And again, Berkeley, and these are stats from the Bureau of Justice, the percentage of blacks on Berkeley's police force is higher than the percentage of blacks in the community. Jim, based on what you know about what's happening in Berkeley, has that mattered? Has it changed things? Has it changed the culture of the police department?
I would say now in Ferguson, I think it's a different story. In Berkeley, no, it hasn't. I think in Berkeley, we see that the African-American population, when I lived there 35 years ago, was 26-27%. It's now 8%. So you have enormous housing pressures, and then you don't have the city council authorizing sufficient public housing or other housing that middle class and poor people, many of whom are African-American, can afford to live. And so then the NAACP, as I said before, has had a big meeting last year about how unfair the policing was. There are videos on YouTube that show the way African-American young people are treated when they go up to campus or someplace where they, quote unquote, shouldn't be. It's not been the magic potion. Now, some cops in Berkeley are doing a good job, and the fact that they're minority is a factor in that. It's just not the magic potion that we had hoped. In Ferguson, however, I think they're in such a primitive place that you need African-American police officers, period, that you have to have that. It's not the Berkeley and Ferguson are two very different places.
Right. Going back to recruiting, we'll talk about whether this changes or where it matters and if you can point to changes. Do you know of any police departments that are actively doing this, the kind of recruiting that you were talking about, Marion?
I have not seen where there's massive diversity hiring, right? It's exactly what Jim says, right? That the people that hiring and the culture keeps a lot of minorities out, right? In OFJ in the 70s got a consent decree against San Francisco police officers. And during that time, it was no women, right? They weren't police officers. The women that they had, the few women they had, they were considered police women, right? They weren't considered sworn police officers. And we sued where you had to hire women, you had to hire people over under 5'6", right? You had to have no age discrimination. I mean, a lot of people who are in the police department now probably would not have been in the police department if it wasn't for OFJ. But blacks wasn't hired as rapidly as others, right? I mean, but it's the same thing. the call for services go probably in black communities and brown communities more frequently. So I would say even if it's 3% now, the majority of the runs that officers go to is probably involving black and brown folks. So I think if it's 50% or 70%, then maybe that's what the police force should look like.
Does this get discussed within the force?
I brought it up, but I'm not sure if they took it seriously, right? But I think the community should, right? This is something. And now I see the community are speaking up, right?
Right.
They want their police department to look different. They want to be treated differently. I mean, for policing to work, you have to be a part of it, right? You have to have a buy-in to it. And black folks never really got that opportunity, right? Like other people does have, right? Because they were, I guess, for years, hundreds of years, they weren't treated as equal. So you're the people that are being policed, right? But the system also is set up where it's money in crime. And when I say it's money in crime, it's money in arresting folk, right? Because if you arrest one person, the attorney gets paid, the police get paid, judges get paid, social workers get paid, everybody gets paid. Somebody got to be in that system, right? And who's more readily identified than us, right? It's easy to arrest us because you see us, right? Other folks can assimilate into the community. They can be whoever they want to be. We can't, right? People dictate who we are. Most people think that black folks, the average or 90% of the black or almost 100% of the black folks are criminal. They're not. They're no more criminal than anybody else. 1%, 2% maybe. These are the people who are criminal, right? But it's in every community. But who get arrested more? We do. Because we're more visual. I mean, we're easier to see. And who's going to really take our complaints?
There's a whole other aspect to this which we haven't covered yet, and that's the crime victims. Like, you have a crime victim who can't speak English, who can only speak a dialogue of Chinese, or can only speak Spanish. And then you have police departments with few, if any, officers who can talk to them. I've heard on tapes, I've heard people who only speak Spanish being interviewed by officers who only speak English. Now, what kind of crime solving is that? You need also these brown and Asian officers who speak these different dialogues for no other reason than they can help solve the crimes afflicting those communities more effectively because they speak the language. The other thing is women. We just have not gone nearly as far hiring women, particularly in command positions, as we should have at this point.
And hold that thought. Women make up almost 15% of police across the country. There are just over 663,000 total police officers nationwide. Today we are talking about what it will take to make police departments more diverse and what sort of changes would that bring to policing. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can post your comment or question on our website, kalw.org, or at yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC, Ira Glass and This American Life at noon, and this afternoon at 1, it's Glenn Washington in this week's edition of Snap Judgment.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a debate about whether there is such a thing as sustainable and humane meat. Is eating beef good or bad for our bodies and the planet? We'll be joined by Nicolette Hahn Nyman, author of Defending Beef, and Jean Bauer, co-founder of The Farm Sanctuary. Be sure to join us tomorrow and let us know where you stand on this issue. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're continuing our series on police, community, race, and justice by talking about the diversity of police forces today. We've got some numbers from the Census Bureau saying that the number of officers of color are on the rise across the country, but they're concentrated in larger cities. The percentage of white cops is more than 30 points higher than in the communities they serve. So what questions and comments do you have about this? What does the force look like in your area? How do we break this cycle? Marion Jackson retired from the SFPD after 36 years, and he says, unfortunately, not much has changed. There's just a lot that needs to be changed in terms of the culture. So what changes would you like to see? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if a force does become diversified, will it matter? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Marion Jackson is a board member with Officers for Justice, an organization representing police of color in San Francisco. It started in 1968. And Jim Channon is a civil rights attorney based in the East Bay. He and fellow civil rights lawyer John Burris have filed many lawsuits against the Oakland Police Department. To that question, changes, Marion, what's at the top of your list? How do we break this cycle?
The only way we break the cycle, I think, is to hire more mature police officers, more diverse police officers, and change the culture of policing in these minority communities, right? The people has to, you have to give the people the power in those communities. I mean, as a police officer, I learned that you're the police for everybody, right, in that community that you work in. And that includes the bad guys too, right? They want to be treated with respect, right, in how you treat them. The community want to be treated with respect, right? I believe that things that happen in poor communities don't happen in richer communities, right? I mean, nobody kicks in their doors without a warrant, right? Nobody does. They don't get stopped as much for traffic, even though they commit traffic violation, right? And it goes back to Ferguson. The police department used those people to sustain the city, right? I mean, everybody had a traffic ticket, right, that pay into, I mean, so it was about money. And sometimes in policing, it is about money. But it's also about keeping the status quo, too, right? I mean, it's a whole myriad of things that we have to change in policing.
Jim, what changes would you like to see to break this cycle?
Well, I was thinking while you two were talking about a building, and I think you can look at a successful police department as a building. The foundation is fair and equal hiring. You have to have a diverse police department racially, sexually, and throughout the community that reflects it. And even if you have an all-white community, you should have some minorities and vice versa. You have to then, on top of that, the next is training. It's not just enough to have the officers. They have to be trained properly. Like we have a professor from Stanford working with OPD on racial profiling, and one of the things she's done in other departments is a shoot, don't shoot policy. And what she's found is that you're more likely to, in that split second, to shoot an African-American in a certain threatening pose than you are a Caucasian person. So you have to work on the psyche of that training. You have to work on how to de-escalate your encounters with minorities, particularly if you're a Caucasian police officer. All these things have to be important. You have to have a fair and honest complaint procedure that will discipline officers who violate the procedures. The next part of the building is community relations. You have to work with the community. The officers, we don't have residency requirements in California. They're unconstitutional. So you can't say, well, everyone has to live in the city. That's illegal and unconstitutional. But what you can have is you can have officers meet the community in non-police-oriented situations, hearing their concerns, understanding their needs, getting feedback from them as to what they should do. The next part of the building is leadership. You have to have effective leadership in the department that can make all these things happen. People who aren't afraid to impose discipline, they're not afraid to hire diverse command staff, and they may be diverse themselves. And finally, you have to have politicians who are in the city who actually are committed to these things, because it's so easy to take the law and order. You take a place like Oakland. We have a lot of crime. And so you can say crime. We just have to stop crime. I don't want to hear about how we do it. I just want to have the crime solved. Well, that attitude, we saw it in New York with Giuliani, and we see it in other places as well. That attitude is devastating for fair and impartial policing.
And I think that's exactly correct. Everything that he said needs to take place. In the late 60s and 70s, San Francisco was the first that I know of started a community relations unit, right, that did exactly what he talked about. They went into the community. They were the community police. Right. They found out what your concerns were and they tried to address it. Right. And they actually took it nationally. The federal government picked up the community relations. Took it. We don't have that kind of community relation no more in San Francisco, but I think they should be in every neighborhood.
Why did it go away?
Other officers, they felt that community relations officer had too much power. The administration itself felt that they did, because when you went into a community and you wanted to make change, the first person they look at is their officer, right? Their community relations officer, and they ask them, is that a good change, right? So a lot of the brass resented that, right? That an officer had that much power, and nobody likes that. So, I mean, we've had it and it's in name only. But it's not effective, because you need a certain amount of people to make it work, right? And you have to interact with the community, which is the most important thing. You can't just come in the community and just arrest folks. You have to be there when there's no arrest. You have to be there when there's other problems going on that you can help in. And that's where they build the confidence in you, right? And crime, actually, with community, crime went down.
Marian Jackson is a board member with Officers for Justice, an organization representing police of color in San Francisco. He retired from the SFPD after 36 years and spent 7 years in the DA's investigations unit. Jim Channon is a civil rights attorney based in the East Bay. He and fellow civil rights lawyer John Burris have filed many lawsuits against the Oakland Police Department, including a 2003 suit over four officers known as the Riders. In 129 plaintiffs allege that the four officers beat them, wrote false reports, and planted drug evidence. There was a settlement. The clients got $10.5 million. The officers were not convicted, and one fled the country. And if you'd like to join us to talk about diversity in police forces, what does your police force look like? Have you been involved in any of the community meetings that Marian was just talking about? The toll-free number, do they even happen in your area? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Sebastian in San Francisco. Hi, Sebastian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My question was that I'm a paramedic in San Francisco, and I was wondering if the statistics show that certain neighborhoods are more dangerous than others, and if you find that people who either come from that neighborhood or are of the same race as that neighborhood would be safer when responding to violent crimes.
Marion, do you want to take that?
I don't think one neighborhood is more dangerous than the other. It's usually, again, goes back to the relationship of that officer with that community. I mean, I've worked in areas where low-income black areas, but I was treated differently, right? In fact, once you build a relationship with that community, they protect you, right? They really do. They protect you because you're their police officer. You're there when they need you. And I think one of the greatest problems that we have, and I hear it all here lately, that I've never heard it before, but now when you talk to officers, it's a fear factor. We're scared, right? Well, you can't be scared and show it and come into the community, because if you look at a lot of those videos, you see, first thing the officer does is pull his gun. How high can you go? You're as high as you can go, and you're not putting it back in your holster, right? So somebody's going to get hurt. When you talk about diversity, maybe when I go into that same situation, I can deflate the anger or whatever's going on by listening and talking to people. But I can't be, I mean, I can be scared, but I can't let that affect my job.
If I could answer.
Sure.
The caller, I mean, just because a community may be classified as a dangerous community does not mean that most of the people there are dangerous. It means that there are dangerous people there. But it also means, because there are dangerous people there, that there's a greater need for the police and for good police in a so-called dangerous community than there is in another community. So all the factors the other speaker said become even more important in a so-called dangerous community rather than less so. You have to realize that there are people in those communities who want the police, who need the police, who need their help, and will be only too happy to ask for it if they feel they're getting fair and impartial policing. We've shown in Oakland more recently that we didn't have a single officer-involved shooting in 2014, the only time I can remember in years where that's happened. We had complaints go down. We had uses of force go down. At the same time, we've had arrests go up. So we don't have depolicing. We have more effective crime fighting because there's respect for the Constitution and for people's rights. And we find that over and over again, that results in more witnesses, more cooperation, better witnesses, and in the end, better crime fighting.
Well, thank you for calling in, Sebastian. Let's go next to Aaron in Marin. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
My question was kind of a deeper rooted question.
Can you turn down your radio, Aaron?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Thank you.
My question is kind of goes beyond some of these other things that I think are very important, and it is: can we truly eradicate racism, sexism, and many of these other isms, and develop a semblance of equality within a very segment of the larger societal mechanism of capitalism that really acts as the enforcer of that belief system, when that belief system itself is founded upon inequality and violence, and where this happens mainly amongst communities who are directly affected by that very system of inequality?
Jim?
Yes. I recognize that none of these problems are going to get solved completely because of the inequalities in this country that the caller has alluded to. But that doesn't mean we should give up. If we give up, that means we can sit in our house, if we have a nice house, let's say in Marin or somewhere, and we can think about this while meanwhile the people in the poor communities are suffering. So they may get incremental change, but incremental change to someone whose life's been saved from a criminal or whose life has been saved by not getting shot by the police, that may be incremental change in the greater scheme of the cosmos, but to that person, it's not incremental. It's everything. Mm. So I'm going to keep working within a reform system and do the best that I can, all the while knowing it'll never be enough.
Mm. Well, and thank you for calling, Aaron. Marian, Aaron's question raised something. We talk a lot about diversifying the police force, but we're not even really talking about the experience of the cop of color. And as someone who spent 36 years at SFPD, what do you want to share with us about what you dealt with? Because Reuters had a piece in late December that got a lot of attention called Off-Duty Black Cops in New York Feel Threat from Fellow Police. Reuters interviewed 25 black male officers of the NYPD, 15 of whom are retired, 10 of whom are still serving. According to the piece, all but one said that when off-duty and out of uniform, they had been victims of racial profiling, which refers to using race or ethnicity as grounds of suspecting someone of having committed a crime. The officer said this included being pulled over for no reason, having their heads slammed against the cars, getting guns brandished in their faces, being thrown into prison vans, and experiencing stop and frisks. The majority of the officers said they were pulled over multiple times while driving. Five had guns pulled on them. Most spoke anonymously because they're still cops.
Right. And that's true. One of my greatest fears was being black and a black man with a gun. Several years ago, I saw a magazine. They put out a magazine, I guess, by Ebony or whatever, where they showed that black officers were killed by white officers, and a lot of them were in uniform, because what they see is black. They don't see police on your back or whatever, right? Not too long, Oakland black cop got killed basically the same way, right? But I stopped pulling my gun because I fear for my safety, because I had numerous times guns pulled on me.
While you were in uniform?
No, I was plain clothes.
Plain clothes,
I was with other officers. I was with other officers. And it wasn't like I was out there by myself. I was with other officers. And for some reason, they focus in on me, right? But I'm sure it happens to other officers of color, right? But it's the prejudice that you assume that every black person is a criminal. Every black person with a gun is not necessarily a criminal, right? Some of them are decent folk. And so that you have to change the attitude of the officer, right? We get trained in the academy a lot of times on who the bad guy is. And usually the bad guy is the black guy, right? And that's, like he said, that's not always true. It's the same percentage in each community, basically. It's about 1 or 2%. But so training is good. Training is, you have to, and Jim brought it up, it's that shoot, don't shoot mentality. It's good to go to the range and learn how to shoot, but they don't teach you who to shoot, right? But they do have training, what they call FATS training, where they, it's a shoot, don't shoot thing, where you have to actually do critical thinking, right? And see who is a threat and who's not a threat. Because I got a gun don't make me a threat. And you hear, well, he went for a gun, or he had a gun, or he looked like he had a gun. Well, that's no cause to shoot anybody, right? First of all, you have to know how to respond to that. I mean, they killed a 12-year-old kid within 3 seconds. That's not acceptable, right? Or they killed some crazy person with a knife who was feet away from him. That's not acceptable, right? But they all appear to be black or brown, because they did the same thing to a young brown man.
Did you have conversations about this with your fellow white officers, talking about the implicit bias? Recently, Florida banned the use of mugshots in police target practice because they were using black men as target practice.
And that happened because when I first came in the police department, they had targets that were black figures, right? And then now they changed them to white. They were actually white figures. But it, the mental attitude of a person, you know, when you're trained in the academy or wherever that the threat is coming from the black community, that's how you're going to treat it. And young officers are trained in black areas where they learn, to me, I believe, bad policing. Because you should be trained in some of the upper class communities so you know how to police, right? I mean, you have to actually police in those communities, right? You have to treat citizens like citizens, but not in black and brown communities. You don't.
And I should say this happened in North Miami Beach City. The council there decided to ban this. Jim, you want to jump in?
One of the things we're looking at in Oakland is these video cameras, which we now require almost all the time when a police officer has some contact with a member of the community. And I believe that's one of the reasons our complaints dropped in half almost in 2014. It's not the only reason, but it's a real good one. But we're also using the film to look at what happens when a black officer pulls over an African-American person? What is the difference? How does they look? How do they approach that person? The second someone gets pulled over and the officer gets out of the car, it's so important how they act, whether they act the same way as they do with a white person, whether they're pulling over white people for the same reasons. And now we can see by actual what happened out there in the field and use it as a training device. And I think that's very important, and I'm hoping that other departments will do that. I just want to jump in here with one other thing. I think your callers should know that one of the big problems we have here in California, which is probably going to shock a lot of people who haven't heard it before, is the issue of police secrecy in California. We are not allowed to see any aspect of an officer's complaint history or his personnel file. The incident that was just talked about happened in Cleveland, where a young boy was shot by a Cleveland police officer. A couple of days later, a town of Independence, Ohio, said, look at this guy's personnel file. He wasn't suited to be a police officer. That's why we got rid of him. In California, you'd go to jail for doing that. Our legislature, Democratic-controlled, has decided in its wisdom, and I use that word sarcastically, to ban all access to police complaint history and all access to police personnel records. Now, I'm obviously in favor of not giving the officer's address, his medical or her medical history, or other identification such as Social Security, et cetera. But the complaint history, that should be public. When I testified at Assembly Committee about 8 or 9 years ago, one of the Assembly people said, well, Mr. Channon, how would you like it if your disciplinary record as a lawyer was on the Internet? And I said, well, you know, it doesn't really matter how I like it because that's where it is. I said, every lawyer has their discipline record on the Internet, and we don't even get paid by the public. And that's the way it should be for police officers. You should be able to know that the people you hire have been disciplined and what they've been disciplined for. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just plain common sense that the public should be able to know who they're paying for.
And is this because the power of the police union?
Yes.
Marion, do you think that should be changed?
I think so. I think that if there's a bad officer, the people should know. I mean, one of the problems I see all the time in police shootings, right? The police brings up the person that got shot record. He was a criminal. He was this or that. But they never talk about it, like he said, what the police did, right? You know, they convict him on his record or her record and not what happened. And I think that's an injustice.
I want to read a few comments. We're almost out of time, and then I'll get final thoughts. Mark, we don't have time to take your call, but thank you for calling. Mark says it's time to bring back the beat cop and stop seeing people as criminals, but as human beings. Lisa says, regarding diversity, it's important, but not the only thing that'll change police behavior. I'm from L.A., and let me tell you, the Black and Latino officers were every bit as arrogant and prone to shows of excessive force as the white officers. I've seen this, and so have my friends and family. Paula writes in and says that racism comes from the top down. This is happening in police departments across the country. She also brought up the target practice in Florida. Jim, as you said, this is a complex issue. While we do need diversity in the force, as you said, it might not change what you're looking for. But can you talk about where you want this to go? Do you think that we will see changes because we're having this national conversation?
Oh, I think this national conversation is highly positive. I don't know where it's going. I'm not, even though I'm a lawyer, I can't see into the future. So I don't know if this is going to be the fad of the month or something that's really going to take hold. But I agree with the caller who said that, having a diverse police department is not the be-all and end-all, but it is essential. But beyond that, you need proper training, you need proper discipline, you need proper ways to approach people that are given from the top down, and you need to know if you're bad to somebody, there are going to be consequences higher up rather than someone will pat you on the back and say, attaboy or attagirl.
Jim Channon is a civil rights attorney based in the East Bay. You can read about the lawsuit in 2003 over four police officers known as the Riders at yourcallradio.org. Marion Jackson is a board member with Officers for Justice, an organization representing police of color in San Francisco. He retired from the SFPD after 36 years. Marion and Jim, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. For
thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Is there such a thing as sustainable and humane meat? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about whether eating beef is good or bad for our bodies and the planet. Nicolette Han Nyman, author of Defending Beef, argues that cattle can help mitigate climate change and provide nutrition. Jean Bauer, co-founder of Farm Sanctuary, argues that humane labels are misleading. Animals labeled as naturally raised are confined by the thousands in factory farms. So where do you stand on this issue? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Wynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.